Jesus care for his disciples? Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that Peter, John, and other fishermen get a surplus of fish before they have to step away. And you just see this Lord saying, I need you in my work, but I also know you have physical needs. And you see him care for that. And in this case, we're talking about it at a societal level, but it is a practice of the Lord to care for us.
Even something like feeding the 5,000, where Jesus is like, they're hungry. And the disciples are like, well, he's like, you should go feed them. And like, well, look, I'll feed them.
Poor Philip. Yeah. Philip, what are you going to do?
I checked. You tell me, sir.
Hi, and welcome to Conversations with Interpreter. I am Thora Shannon, one of your hosts.
And I'm Avram Shannon, your other host.
And today we're going to be talking with a pair of brothers who also wrote a paper together. So today we'll first introduce John, the older brother. So John Cochran II was born in Las Vegas, Nevada, and raised in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Roosevelt, Utah. He earned a BS in biochemistry from Utah State University and an MD from Ross University School of Medicine, and completed his family medicine residency at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines, Iowa. He currently practices family medicine in Southern Arizona. And we're so grateful he can be with us on Zoom today, or
virtually.
Virtually today.
Okay, good. So the other, Joe Cochran, Joseph D. Cochran, was raised primarily in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Roosevelt, Utah. You can see some moving happening here in this family based on these biographies. Before graduating with a bachelor's degree in secondary education from Brigham University in Provo, after teaching social studies in a middle school for 5 years, Joe committed a doctorate degree at Utah State University in curriculum and instruction with an emphasis in teacher education. He is currently an adjunct professor in the ancient scripture and church history and doctrine departments at Brigham University. Now, he reaches his primary on helping gospel teachers understand and approach telling scripture stories, like the delineation of controversial ideas in secondary schools. But today, we're looking at a paper that they published recently with the Interpreter, a journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship. So today we're looking at a paper that John and Joe wrote together, the Doctors Cochran, we'll call them, called From Wilderness to Covenant Threshold, Land, Literacy, and Religious Readiness in the Book of Mormon. This article was published in the Interpreter, a journal of Latter-day Saint Faith and Scholarship, and it's available on their website. And so can we... give us a little discussion. So what's the thesis? What's the idea behind this paper?
Well, and also what led both of you to writing a paper together? I'd love to hear.
That's super fun, actually.
It was super fun. It's something, you know, there's a lot of ideas in here, as you've kind of read that, you know, we're kind of stirring and thinking about. I mean, I kept bouncing off my brother and trying to put them all together. And so this idea that was most interesting to me is, why does Amulon get much time in the Book of Mormon? Why does Mormon spend any time with him? And what is the importance? And, you know, trying to figure that out, you read a little before, you read a little after, and you try to put this story together. And so just after times of ideas and bouncing off, the kind of the article came together, and we tried to make sense of why Amulon's got some time.
Yeah, and just add to how the paper came together. As he said, he'd call me, and I've published a little bit of religious scholarship myself, and we just bounce our ideas. I'd push back sometimes, like, I don't get this, and he'd talk me through it. And it's really just that President Ezra Taft Benson quote that says, why, we should step back and ask ourselves, why are Mormon, Moroni, Nephi including this? And there's a clear time where Mormon pauses the narrative, and he's like, and Amulon did this and this and this. And you're like, but Amulon's a bad guy. What are you doing, Mormon? And I think this article's the answer to that question, or at least our attempt to understand Mormon.
That's an interesting, you know, background, thinking about these motivations of why does Mormon include things, I think can really lead to so much expansion of knowledge when we really start to explore that. I also want to briefly mention, Avram and I have written together too, so I think it's really fun to have a co-author and to be able to bounce ideas off of each other, especially sometimes the pushback isn't so fun, but it's nice to have that when you're writing versus on your own when you're just have yourself and have to decide, is this a good idea or not? So I think it's a neat way to write a paper and to be able to finesse ideas together. So I think it's exciting that you're able to do that. So I have, you know, a question about it. So in your paper, you talk about how having the land use among the Lamanites changes, and how this helps them lead to what you call a covenant and helps them proceed to a place where they are at, you know, covenant readiness and a covenant threshold where they're ready to listen to the missionaries, you know, the sons of Mosiah. And so you do mock this in your paper, but can you maybe talk about how does this differ from someone like Abraham or Moses, who were more...
not really using land.
Yeah, not using land the same way. They're more itinerant, and yet they also made covenants. So could you maybe talk about how the Lamanites are differing here from the cases of Abraham or Moses?
Where land use came up to me is when I was exploring kind of what happened before Amulon was this concept is we have King Mosiah abandoned the land of Nephi under commandment of the Lord and went north to the land of Zarahemla, but there was a group that wanted to go back. There was led back by Zerubbabel. When he came back, he went back to the city of Nephi and noticed that the city, which they left not too long ago, was now in disarray. The walls were, the city just wasn't taken care of. The crops were already taken over. He approached the Lamanite king and said he wanted to take over the land again. They allowed him to do it. So this idea that a land could so easily, quickly decay after not being abandoned so soon, even though it was well under Lamanite control, was fascinating. And they do spend about a chapter or two talking about what type of land. So it starts with when Zenith returns back to the land of Nephi after King Mosiah abandoned it by commandment. He found the city Nephi and the land of Nephi in disarray, the walls not being maintained, the crops and the ground not being maintained. And he petitioned the king of Lamanites to take over, which he was allowed to, and he rebuilt the land. I found it fascinating that that short, it wasn't a very long period, but between the time that King Mosiah left and Zenith returned, that there was that so much of someone who didn't seem to know how to take care of the land at that point. And when we read scriptures, there's a lot of things where we are, you know, told to take care of the land as part of the covenant with the Lord. And when, so looking at how land is taken care of, how it is treated well, was one of the signs to see if someone is ready to make the next step. It says, you know, in the book of Leviticus, where he says, you should not sell the land. You should not sell the land. The land is mine, and you are, I think it's sojourners and strangers with me on it. So that's a concept that's well known in the scriptures, that the Lord gives us the land for the hope that we should take care of it.
Okay, so building on this idea of land use and covenants, one of the things you said, a phrase I found very, very actually sort of compelling in its usage, is this idea of temples follow granaries, right? And it's kind of a very evocative phrase, and maybe a little bit of a push there. So talk to us about what you mean when you say temples follow granaries. Can you expand on this concept a little bit?
Concept that temples follow granaries is this idea of when a population is worried about where their food is coming and they're worried about scarcity, they usually do not take time to think about higher stuff such as religion and all that. The thing that most easily compares to me is when you follow Egyptian history, the temples of Egypt were depleted and constructed during times of surplus. When the Nile was not flooding, there's times of drought, they were called down periods in the Egyptian time period, where this worship that they were so focused on did not happen. Same concept has here. If I'm trying as a missionary to teach someone the gospel and they're looking for their next meal, the odds of them spending time to listen to what I have to say is not very good, especially when you compare it to a society that's having the same issue compared to just individuals.
One of the things really interesting about that is just even broader. I really like this idea of the sense. One, of course, the individual notion of why, of course, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints cares so much about both preaching the gospel, but also about taking care of the poor and the needy. That both of these things are part of the Church's mission because people need both. And so I think that's a really intriguing thing, both on a sort of broad anthropological level, but also on sort of an individual sort of almost salvational level, I think is compelling. Because every so often, I'll have students who say, well, you know, we've got this, we've got temples, we've got mission work. I'm like, we're also taking care of the poor because this is actually part of their growth. So I really think that's an intriguing thing you brought out there.
I mean, how many times do we see Jesus care for his disciples? Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that Peter, John, and other fishermen get a surplus of fish before they have to step away. And you just see this Lord saying, I need you in my work, but I also know you have physical needs. And you see him care for that. And in this case, we're talking about it at a societal level, but it is a practice of the Lord to care for us.
even something like feeding the 5,000, where the God's like, Jesus is like, they're hungry. And the disciples are like, well, he's like, you should go feed them. And like, well, look, I'll feed them. And then he moves on with it. So, yeah,
poor Philip. Yeah. Philip, what are you going to do?
You tell me, sir.
So let's go back to this. We've already talked a little bit about this covenant threshold, but let's really like expand on that. What does this term mean that you guys introduce in your paper? And how do you see that occurring with these Lamanites? So like, how are they reaching the covenant threshold in the Book of Mormon?
One of the things that's unique in this scenario is we're looking at a community as a whole. And as these people get converted to the Lord, you start to lose names. Like take Lamoni and we follow his story and then he just disappears. And you learn about the old king and he's wonderful. And then he just fades to the background. Like, and we have a new king and you hear a little bit about him, but mostly what the narrative turns into is a story of a people, not a story of individuals. And that's kind of what we're talking about here is that the Lord has prepared this people. And the covenant threshold, while it could potentially be looked at a smaller scale, we're looking at a broad scale. These people are going to enter into a covenant together and they're going to keep these covenants together. It's not a couple of people that are burying their weapons. It is multiple communities committing to do this. And then they move as a community to the land of Jershon. And it's a fascinating moment where you see it's more about the people and their covenants than it necessarily is about individuals. And that's kind of what we're looking at here is like, look at how Amulon has prepared these people so that when the missionaries come, these people are ready to respond, not just individuals.
So I'd like to expand on that a little bit because, again, just because, I mean, if people haven't read it at home or they're going to go read it or whatever. So explain, so what happens then that makes the Lamanites able to accept this covenant? What is this thing that happens that's this conversion from individuals to this people covenant thing? It's related to the land we see. It's related to being able to eat. So what is the change between, again, we've read the Book of Mormon before, but let's make it explicit here, between what Lamanites before, Lamanites after, that makes them able to listen to Ammon and his brothers?
Well, one of the things that we believe that was not the change was the sincerity and the faith of the missionaries. We read in Jacob and Enos that they sent missionaries there. They were not successful. So it wasn't the missionaries themselves that was the change. Now, there's no doubt that, you know, Ammon and the sons of Mosiah were faithful. They had the right intent. They knew what they wanted to do, but they approached the Lamanites that were in a different place than Enos and Jeremiah did at that time. The main catalyst that kind of made this change was Amulon, who was one of the wicked priests of King Noah. It's especially poignant when you look at how Zenith records how the Lamanites were living before Amulon and how the sons of Mosiah found them living shortly after. Within about like 40, 50 years, there's a change that happens. Amulon, who he abandoned his family, he kidnapped the Lamanites' daughters and was found by the Lamanites, and they, for some reason, took compassion on him. And then they found the people of Alma the Elder, who was raising the church there, he put them over them. But in the meantime of that, we know that Amulon was teaching the Lamanites commerce, teaching them the language of the Nephites, teaching them how to keep track of their records, keep track of the money for. We don't believe he was doing that because he wanted them to be converted. I think he probably wanted to go back and find where he lost when the kingdom of Noah fell apart. But these types of changes made the Lamanites in a more organized society of more structured leaderships where there was teachers and there were people there and the leaders that could help out. And so when the sons of Mosiah came in, they came into a structure that allowed the gospel to spread better and to make, like my brother mentioned, with certain proclamations of bearing the weapons and making movements more available and easier for the gospel to spread in that.
You know, this makes me think, it's not in the Book of Mormon, but in the Old Testament, it talks about how God uses the Babylonians, you know, to bring to pass his will, not because they're righteous, but because he's using like anything he can to bring about his plans, right? And I think we see that again with Amulon, where it's not that Amulon, I mean, in fact, Mormon tells us specifically he isn't teaching them, you know, the covenant. So he's not teaching them about what's on the brass plates or the commandments, but God is still using someone who isn't working for God's purposes to bring about God's purposes.
Yeah, it's one of the most beautiful paradoxes about God is that he can turn awful things to our good. And I think sometimes we express that in our culture incorrectly, where someone experiences something poorly, like he was on his mission when this happened, but we grew up in a small community where just about everyone in the family died in a car accident, save for a 9-year-old boy. And I remember going to the funeral, President Blake K. Packer came. It was a big deal for a small community. And people sure. say, it's part of God's plan. It's part of God's plan. And I know what we're trying to say, but if we step back, you're saying, so does God have a whiteboard? And he's like, kill family off, check. If so, now we know where Disney gets their narrative. Yeah. But what we're trying to say is what you're pointing out here, that it's not that God has a plan that negative things happen, but God's plan is to put us in a world where negative things happen, and that he can turn even the ambulance, the worst of the worst, the kidnapping, the terrible men, and somehow turn their assimilation efforts into something good. Like, that is Jesus to a nutshell. I mean, his atoning sacrifice is something that we sometimes read about, and it's just so awful what he had to go through, but he turned that into the most amazing, beautiful resurrection morning. And it's just this beautiful paradox that our God is so good that he can take an amulon and turn that to our good.
It is amazing. You know, John, you'd already talked about how it's like, why does Mormon keep talking about amulon, right? But I think it's partly Mormon wants us to see like how the Lamanites are changing and how God can use somebody that isn't righteous to bring about righteous ends.
Absolutely. And again, it's not a unique thing. I mean, the other infamous one you mentioned, the Babylonians, is the concept that the Romans crucified Jesus, but also the concept of the Pax Romana led to the apostles being able to spread the gospel wide beyond that. So there's stuff like that where, despite all the errors and mistakes that we make, the Lord can still make good of that and can still change it in general. And I think Mormon recognized this, took time to write on the plates, which we hear a lot more comments from the writers of the Book of Mormon, how it was not an easy thing to do, and they had limited space, but they felt this was important enough that they needed to show this going forward. And I think this is key to know why the Sons of Mosiah were so successful beyond their faith, and that this is something that, you know, was written again for our time. It wasn't written for the time of the Nephites to take notes, say, okay, how can we replicate the Sons of Mosiah's success? It's written for us to observe, to pick up the narratives that the Mormon is writing for us, and to see what we can do with them in this day.
I like that. I also like this notion of really, we highlighted already, John, I appreciate that. Enjoy a little bit of this too. This notion of as we think about some of these things, and okay, talk about missions. You know, when I was a young missionary, we had in our mission, and so some missions do, and every mission's different a little bit, but we had this, you know, the president would give an award to a missionary every transfer or whatever. That was, you know, an example of good work, you know, just kind of helping us in the work and whatever. And ours was called the Ammon Award. And I remember, and this kind of speaks to your paper, we're kind of talking a little bit here today. I remember, even as a missionary, reading this and saying, yeah, but Ammon's circumstances aren't really replicatable, right? What I'm doing in Portland, Oregon, is not what's happening with the Lamanites. And we see this in the Book of Mormon, where this great Lamanite mission, it's not, and get you do a nice job of laying this on your paper, it's not so much that Ammon's the best missionary, and he'll say this in his little discussion with Aaron there, but it's much more this notion that good missionary work makes good missionaries, and the actual process of it is much more about many other factors. And I just think that's
a people who are ready to be prepared to accept the gospel, like the Lamanites, which I think has been helpful. I haven't served a mission, but I know, you know, some people go to places where you get a ton of converts, and some people go to places where you get one convert, and that might be yourself, like really converting to the gospel mm-hmm. more. And that's not a reflection necessarily on any one missionary, but more on how more people are prepared or less prepared. And sometimes it's individually, and sometimes it's more as a society, like we see in the Book of Mormon, where the Lamanites were really at this tipping point where they were ready to hear the gospel. And of course, we see Ammon, who has great success initially, and then we see Aaron, who's thrown into prison initially. But eventually also has great success. But then we have people, you know, modern day who might not have any success, but that doesn't mean, you know, you know, you talk about in your paper, it's not that the seed is bad, right? The seed is always good. You know, the gospel from the parable that Christ gives, but it's the soil that sometimes isn't ready. And it is a really neat part of the Book of Mormon. I have to say, you know, the Book of Mosiah is probably my favorite book. And I just love seeing this huge change we see in society throughout that book about people really being able to embrace the covenants that God has for them.
Yeah, John and I were talking about this earlier today, and I mean, I served a mission in Mexico City. It was a wonderful experience. It was a place where the people were ready.
Sure.
But there were sometimes missionaries, and I hope I never said it out loud, but I'm sure I thought it in my dumb pride, that would think, well, it's us. And I do know some missionaries would actually say out loud, send us to Germany, we'll show them how. And it was like this, it was this discussion that like any airman could baptize anywhere, and it's this complete like I don't know what the right word might be, but the ignorance to this idea that it is God that is the gardener. And you brought up Aaron and Ammon's conversation. Like Aaron at one point's like, Ammon, you're boasting a little bit here.
Back up, friend.
We did it. And Ammon's like, I'm not boasting me. He doesn't say I'm a bad missionary, but he's like, it's not about me. Yeah. It's about God. And that, I think that's what this covenant threshold is like God has prepared them in such a way that they can then use their agency to act forward. And Ammon and Aaron, God bless them, they go on a mission. It makes a difference. Don't get us wrong. Our missionary efforts make a difference, but it's not everything. When we make covenants, they don't make a covenant with Ammon. They make a covenant with God. And it's so important to see God making that possible.
I agree. And this, you know, this idea we learn about in the Jacob's allegory of the Olive Garden, he's in there working the garden with us. And he says, and I mentioned in Alma, where Alma teaches the people, where he says he's sending angels before us to prepare the ground. And this concept that the Lord is very much involved with his own missionary work. And we ask, hey, can we help? And he's like, sure, let's get to work. And no point are we there to, you know, let's test the soil, let's see if we should do anything. We're told to cast the seed wherever we are, and then the Lord prepare it. God, there's this one time in my mission where I clearly knew in my head I had to go to this house, to this door, and knock at this time. It was perfectly clear. So I was like, okay, Elder, we're going to go. We hopped in our bikes. We rode our bikes there. We got there at the time. We knew the exact door where to knock, knocked on it. No one answered. I mean, what does that mean? It doesn't mean really much of anything, but I was where I was supposed to be for an opportunity for someone to accept the gospel. Jacob, Enos, Jerem, all the missionaries before the sons of Ham, they tried, they prayed, they got promises from the Lord because of their prayers and because of their faith that the Lamanites would be remembered. And a lot of that was fulfilled when Ammon and his brethren approached the land. But we always have to remember that the Lord of the vineyard is in there with us, working with us, preparing the land for us. And he graciously allows us to do what little we can do to help with that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I love when you're talking about the whole thing with the olive tree and Jacob. One of my favorite parts of that part, the thing that you do here, is where the servants are like, Lord, this place is bad soil. Like, why are you trying to plant something here? And he's like, don't tell me what to do. I know it was bad soil, but I'm doing something with this tree that you can't understand. And sometimes, again, on our missions, even our callings and our families, I've had experiences where I'm like, God, this is bad soil. What are we doing with this? And God's like, no, I understand better than this than you do. And sometimes I think I do know. I mean, you read this here. I suspect there were times when, maybe not Jacob or Enos, but when some of the missionaries before Ammon were like, what are we even doing? Why are we wasting our time?
Well, I mean, Ammon tells us that very thing. Yeah. He says, when we told our friends we're going to go out, they said, it'd be better we just go kill them. You have no hope. Like, at some point, the Nephites thought it was just such bad soil. And I imagine Alma the Elder and his people might have felt the same thing. Like, Amulon's bad soil. What are you doing? And I like Brother Brad Wilcox put it this way. The greatest revealer of Christ's power is time. And you see with the passage of time how somehow Amulon and his bad soil is shifted through the good gardener into fertile soil.
Although I think it's important to note, it's not that Amulon himself ever reconverts back. And, you know,
still a bad guy.
We definitely see this kind of schism develop in the Lamanites, where you have these Lamanites who've been prepared and are ready to make covenants. And as you've already talked about, they move to the land of Jershon. And then you have these Lamanites that don't. Many of the leaders of whom, almost all leaders of whom, were actually Nephites, right? Like you have...
Followers of Amulon, actually, right?
You have Amulon and you have other dissenters who come over, Zoramites, Malachites. And they're all Nephites that have really turned away from this light. But you see so much of the actual Lamanites, like descended from Lamanites, or, you know, perhaps others who joined them, who are ready to make that covenant and do. And it's interesting how you see these kind of shifting identities, I guess, in the Book of Mormon, as people turn away from the light of the gospel or are ready to turn towards it.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. Like you said, even to the, you know, when as we're reading through the Book of Mormon, they get to the point where almost all the Lamanites are converted and the Nephites are the people that are having problems. So they eventually got to that point. It took a while. We had to kick out the Nephites that are stirring up trouble. But this idea that the Lord remembers the Lamanites, he remembers the promises. He was working with them all along. It wasn't on the timetable that perhaps the Nephite prophets and saints thought it was, but he got them to the place they need to be. And he will get us to the place we need to be with time and with faith and with good people to enter in our lives that will take advantage of that too.
That's great. Thank you. I think that's really important for us, remembering that. Again, to Joe's point, to the whole thing here, this idea of again, God is the gardener, right? And he's the one, he's over and about this work. So kind of building off of that and sort of thinking through these here, as we've talked about some really, really interesting ideas here, what are some of the strong implications of this idea of covenant threshold, of this idea of God's preparation? We've kind of talked some of these things, but what does this mean for us as modern readers of the Book of Mormon?
I mean, a lot of this that I believe the church is doing this already is this outreach programs we have with church welfare, with perpetual education fund that we have back in the day, with the perpetual immigration fund, is we're getting people in a place where they are not driven by the stressors or distracted by the things of the world, that they can then take time to reflect on God, reflect on his love, make covenants with him, and then become covenant makers and covenant sharers of that Abrahamic promise there. So a lot of the church is doing this, is preparing soil. I mean, a lot of people who take advantage of sorrow still don't accept the gospel. That's not really the point of it. It's the point of it is that we can now recognize that these programs that we do, whether it be as simple as saying hi to someone, oh, they didn't come to church, but we're now friends with them with our ministering, or that we smile at people at the grocery store, just basic stuff like this has helped preparing that soil. And the Lord is doing a lot more than we ever could. And eventually that time will come when the sons of Mosiah or us will be invited to go into a group that beforehand everyone thought there's no chance this is going to happen. I mean, Zenith's initial mission to the Lamanites was to wipe them out. That's what he went down there with his army, and then he saw them and said, we probably shouldn't do this, and they got in a fight. So these are people who at one point were condemned to, this isn't just going to work out, to the point that they're the righteous. They have their own prophet, Samuel the Lamanite, prophesying and teaching about Jesus Christ. And so those opportunities exist. And again, I can't stress how much this book is written for our time and for us to learn and to read from. And this is, I feel, is an important story because it helps us understand how we can help spread the gospel and prepare the land and prepare the people for the gospel's coming.
Thanks.
Yeah. I'm thinking of President Oak's recent talk, Need for a Church. And he shares the story of a young woman who has a troubles going to church, doesn't enjoy it. And President Oak says, she hits this point where she says, well, am I going to get, or am I going to give? And he says that is the heart of why we go to church. Yes, we make covenants with God, but we go together and gather as a community. And the further I seem to understand my covenants, the more I understand that while I'm covenanting to love God, one of the easiest and perhaps the most accessible ways to love God is to love his children and to care for his children. And we are in covenant communities. Most of our covenants are about caring for one another and loving one another. And so we see that the Lord's setting up these people in the Book of Mormon to be able to do that for one another. And equally, whether it's through our agency or whether it's through his amazing gardening, I think he's trying to push us in that same direction. It's like, it's not just that you're covenanting with me. Like, I need you to be Zion. We're talking about building Zion, and Zion the people will precede Zion the place. And we have to learn to be this covenant people. And you can see, as my brother mentioned, and we can see it in the church is doing all types of things. They're building temples, they're building greeneries, they're doing everything they can to help us build Zion. And it's a recognition that Zion isn't just a spiritual place, it's a temporal place that we as a people are going to have to create.
One of the things I love, I mean, there's lots, but Documents 29:34 is one of my favorite passages in the entire Doctrine and Covenants. And there God, he says, you know, he's talking and he says, look, guys, I never gave you a commandment that was temporal. Every commandment I gave from Adam forward has always been a spiritual commandment. Sometimes, and I'm guilty of this too, sometimes we try and divide this out. We're like, oh, well, is this for their spiritual welfare or their physical welfare? And of course, God's point is, it's for their welfare, that it's to help them. And I really appreciate, again, one of the things this paper, I think I really like about this paper is the way it brings out this notion of how important it is for us to think about the entire person, right? As missionaries, we did sometimes, maybe we're better missionaries than I was. Hopefully we were. But, you know, it is sometimes be like you really focused on keep them the teaching, get them to the thing, get them accept these things so we can get them all baptized for it and recognize that, no, what we're saving here is people, is souls. We're helping them make covenants with Christ for all of them. And so I really appreciate what you just shared there about this, both the programs the church is doing, the ideas that the church is trying to get everybody. Because Zion, yes, everyone dwells in righteousness. Yes, they're one heart and one mind. And yes, there are no poor among them. All three of those things are part of Enoch Zion there in Moses 7.
Yeah, I think it's great points. So just to finish up, before we close out, do you guys have any more plans to write together?
Anything cool you're working on?
Yeah, we have an article that's under review right now looking at Elijah and his responsibilities as a prophet. And he has a journey that he goes through. We're looking at the journey from Mount Carmel to Horeb and how you get this very performative Elijah versus this very quiet, still Elijah, and the lessons he's learning and how that has to apply to us. Particularly, we're looking at it from a pedagogical standpoint of how we can care for the people in our stewardship as we see Elijah learning from his own stewardship.
It's another article that I'd really like, and I can just shortly tell you that I will continue to bother my brother about other articles and thoughts I have to the point that he probably does a ID me on when I call him and all that, but I'll still do it. And he's a good voice to bounce off, especially when I'm kind of a little bit isolated here in Southern Arizona. I need someone to bounce off to. So
it's great. Family is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I imagine you'll see more articles from both of us in the future.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for coming today. Appreciate you, John. Appreciate you, Joe.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Conversations with Interpreter. To read the articles and scholarship discussed today, visit interpreterfoundation.org. Be sure to subscribe and share this episode with others who seek learning by study and by faith.